Welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a freelance videographer, film student, and movie reviewer. But right now, he's better known as a podcaster, hosting shows like Garrulous, the ADR podcast, and of course, the True Detective Season 2 recaps for the TV show right here on The Incomparable. So welcome to the show, Brian Hamilton.
Thank you so much for having me tonight, Anthony.
I'm looking forward to this one. So, because this is, so far, most of the things that people have come to talk about are things that are genuinely maligned, but that everybody's heard of. This is one of those cases where not only is it maligned, but it's also pretty much unheard of by most people. It's just that the people who have heard of it, a lot of them didn't like it. So tell us what you have chosen and then give us some context around it, around its release, its reception upon release, why it's maligned and overlooked, in fact, and why you think that that is wrong.
So I've chosen for this episode 2008's Repo: The Genetic Opera. It is a rock musical made by the same guys that made Saw. So you can imagine that it's gritty and bloody, really interesting, really weird. But you're right, nobody has heard of it. So if you have heard of it, congratulations, you might have seen it. You might have had somebody like me pull you into their apartment for a night and be like, yo, listen, this movie's really crazy. Let's watch it together. And you may not like the movie if you've seen it, but you're almost guaranteed a good time. So this is made by the same guys that made Saw, and the cast is absolutely insane. It was made by Lionsgate, or at least produced by Lionsgate, but when they saw the finished product, they ended up not giving it a very wide release at all. So the directors ended up taking it around the country. Like, they toured with the movie and booked small theaters. Like, I've seen this in a church. I've seen it in an art house theater. I've seen it a bunch of weird little places that nobody else would have thought to have gone to see in a movie like this. But it got no release whatsoever, and it's got a cult following, but the people that matter do not like it. It has, I believe, a 30-something on Rotten Tomatoes, and it got no box office revenue back. So Lionsgate completely dropped it, and the directors and producers are completely on their own with this movie. But it lives on as a sort of cult following. It's a lot of people have considered it a spiritual successor to the Rocky Horror Picture Show in its sensibilities and its weird little quirks, the way it was produced, the way that, you know, people interact with the movie. It's got shadow casts around the country like Rocky Horror. So this is one of those movies that if you love it, you love it. And if you've seen it, you've probably enjoyed it, but you can say it's a not very good movie. And if you're a critic, then you probably hate it statistically.
Well, and you, I recall you saying to me, you have seen this movie like 50 plus times.
I have, yes. Simply because I show it to people all the time. This is this isn't me, you know, watching it three times a night in my apartment.
Hey, could have been.
It could have been. I've done that a few times. Once I got the nice, pretty Blu-ray release, I watched it a few times to get all the commentaries down.
Wait, this is available on Blu-ray?
It's available. I have a DVD. There's a Blu-ray with some extra stuff thrown in. I think one extra commentary and a bunch of deleted scenes. But no, it is hard to find. That's the thing.
And, I mean, you mentioned that it was a box office flop. I'm actually just looking here at the Wikipedia page, assuming this is correct. They have the budget listed as $8.5 million, which is pretty cheap by movie standards. But the box office is $188,000. That's really bad.
It's really bad. And I blame Lionsgate for that simply because they gave it no advertising. They gave it no backing. They gave it nothing, literally nothing. So,
well, and only showing it on 8 screens. I mean, that's, you know, that's never going to help, is it?
Exactly. No, I had a friend who, the guy that told me about this movie the very first time, saw its New York premiere. And he said it was on literally a 50-inch TV in the middle of a bar or something like that.
Oh, wow.
It's insane.
You're right that it is, I mean, one of the first things that pretty much within, I'd never heard of this, I should state it at the outset, I had literally never even heard of this movie, which I actually feel bad about because having now seen it, it is clearly a movie aimed at people like me.
Right.
And I actually feel kind of bad. I feel like I should hand in my goth card for not having even heard of this movie, let alone seen it. And within like 5 minutes of once we got past the opening, which is done in a sort of motion comic style, we'll talk about that in a minute, but once we got past that, within 5 minutes I was like, okay, this is clearly trying to be, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but it was clearly trying to be a sort of spiritual successor to Rocky Horror. As you say, they were, there was so much about it that is like, yeah, these guys clearly love Rocky Horror.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly. I wouldn't say they tried so much as it just happened. I don't know.
Some of the way the ways things are shot and the soundtrack itself, and there's so much about it that, well, and let's, okay, we talked about, we mentioned the cast. Let's bring this up right now. Anthony Stewart Head is one of the main characters in mm-hmm. this movie. And you may not realize this, actually. I don't know, because I know you're quite young, but people like me of a certain age will remember that Anthony Stewart Head had a very long and successful run as Frankenfurter on the British stage, and even released a 7-inch, of which I have the picture disc, of his version of Sweet Transvestite. I'm just a sweet transvestite. The people who made this can't believe that they were unaware of that. And that's just one sort of clue that makes me think, yeah, they knew that that was what they were, you know, trying to do.
That makes sense. I feel like, the main difference between this and Rocky Horror Picture Show, in my mind, are in the music and lyrics, the sensibilities, and the plot, obviously. A lot of the people, when they compare it to Rocky Horror Picture Show, everyone says, what the heck are you talking about? This is about, you know, organ repossession and insane corporate conglomerates and things like that. And like, no, it's relatively similar in the way that it's shot, you're right. But the biggest thing to me is... Rocky Horror was a parody, done very well and very genuinely, but this is not a parody. It's something that's trying to stand on its own in its own right. The lyrics to Rocky Horror reference RKO movies and a bunch of other stuff. Yeah. But this is something that's trying to stand on its own in a way that doesn't, like, you're right.
It is camp, but you're right. It's not camp in a sense of making fun of other things. Yeah. It just has that quite camp sensibility about it. But you're right. And thinking about it, actually, the music in this, Rocky Horror was very much a film interspersed with songs. This feels genuinely more like an opera in that almost the entire movie is performed and sung.
Hi, Nathan.
Meg, how did you get in here? Don't you have a show tonight?
How are you, Nathan?
Busy.
You never were a man of many words, Nate. You told me Shiloh died.
Listen.
Nathan, I promised your late wife I'd be present in Shiloh's life.
Please, Meg. Shiloh's very ill. It's not safe for her to see people. I need to give her medication.
Yeah, it definitely is. The soundtrack, I believe, has 40-something songs. And wow. Wikipedia tells me that it's the soundtrack with the most songs on it ever, even though a lot of the songs are maybe 50, 60 seconds long. It's like, come on, guys. But I feel like this started as an opera in New York on little off-Broadway stages. And it evolved from there in that it was almost entirely song. And you're right, almost all the dialogue in this movie is sung. You're right, Rocky Horror is much more of a musical with like bits of music. And the music is very different. They cited Nine Inch Nails and early 90s industrial as pretty huge influences here on Repo. And you can definitely hear a lot of that. Rocky Horror is much more
rock and roll.
Exactly, rock and roll of its time. They got Meatloaf in there for goodness sake.
Well, and this even has Ogre from Skinny Puppy playing one of the lead characters. I mean, he doesn't, I say lead, he's not not lead in the sense that he has a massive role, but he's a prominent character who gets plenty of screen time. He's an important character in the movie.
Mm-hmm. No, I do want to talk to you about that too, the cast. I feel like, first of all, that every single person in this cast is a cult icon in their own right. And I think it's great that they got everyone together to do this weird little low-budget thing that nobody has ever heard of. But you know, there's so many people in the cast. And one of the things that I feel like people really don't like about this movie, which I can definitely agree with, is that it's really convoluted. There's a ton of stuff going on. The first maybe 20, 25 minutes of this movie are exposition. And even then, you know, in the songs, a lot of the points are driven home so many times. So it's a little convoluted. There's so many characters, so many people to keep track of. And at least they're easy to keep track of, in my eyes at least. But there's so many people in the cast, there's a lot going on, and they're all really great people in their own right.
It is pretty amazing, the cast that they assembled. I mean, you have to figure that. I mean, okay, let's go through them. We have Anthony Head, as mentioned. Paul Sorvino of Goodfellas, Law and Order, and, you know, God knows.
And Pasta Sauce fame.
Yeah, God knows how many other things that you've seen. Bill Moseley, you know, Chop Top from Chainsaw 2.
And my favorites, the Rob Zombie movies that he starred in, which
I think
are
great. Oh, yes, of course, yes. Ogre from Skinny Puppy, as I already mentioned. And then the two, perhaps even more surprising than Anthony Head, Sarah Brightman.
Broadway star extraordinaire.
Just crazy. And Paris Hilton.
My favorite thing when I tell people about this movie is that
I did not even realize that it was her until halfway through.
Yep. My favorite thing about this movie is telling people that Paris Hilton is in it as basically herself, as like a pop diva who is, you know, this weird kind of like awkward sore thumb in this really high profile family.
Although rocking the goth look, and who knew she would do it so well? I was
exactly
kind of like, why don't you look like that all the time? You look so much better.
Agreed. And she looks even better towards the end.
Right. That's my 90s sensibilities coming to the fore, I think. but yeah, it is a crazy, crazy cast. And Sarah Brightman, as I say, as well. I mean, I think this is very much a regional thing. Sarah Brightman over here is known, but she's mainly remembered as a musical star from the 80s who had a couple of hit singles and then kind of vanished. Whereas I gather in America and Japan, funnily enough, she's still regarded as you say, as like a big Broadway star, like the sort of person who will pull in an audience.
She debuted as Christine Daae in, she didn't debut, but she originated the character of Christine Daae in the Andrew Lloyd Webber Phantom of the Opera, who she was married to.
That's right.
And she, I just looked her up on Wikipedia this morning in preparation for this. I didn't know she had singles. Like that blew my mind.
Yeah, so, actual hit singles in the UK. Yeah.
So she, to me, she was always that 80s Broadway star that, I saw this back in high school when I was all listening to Broadway soundtracks and everyone around me was, you know, singing everything, and it was a little obnoxious. But my favorite thing about it was learning about Sarah Brightman after seeing this movie and seeing, oh my God, she has clout in this world.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She is not. She doesn't do a movie like this lightly, you know? Mm-hmm. So she must have just, I don't know, loved the material or loved that it was so different to everything she's done before. I mean, with Anthony Head, it's more kind of, I mean, let's be honest, both Anthony Head and Sarah Brightman, neither of them probably need to work again. You know, they do not need the money. but with Anthony Head, at least he has past form of playing Frankenfurter and doing some, you know, odd, offbeat and low budget roles, because clearly he thinks they're fun. But Sarah Brightman, yeah, is a genuine, like, diva-style opera star. Well, not opera, you know, musical star. I would love to know what attracted her to, what persuaded her to do this movie. I mean, she's good in it. She's great in it. And the duet with her and Anthony Head towards the end is fantastic. That's one of the highlights of the movie.
Look, I told her she was sick.
Nathan, you were hurting me.
Dad!
Your daughter needs a rest.
I'll be fine, hey. Shiloh, don't you fret. Repossessions
Shiloh,
are dangerous. You're not safe.
Shiloh,
Dad,
don't
she's
you
not
fret.
Safe. Miller Tonya is becoming you. You've turned
you
this house
better,
into
I can't
her tooth. Bonnie Warner won this for you. Set her free.
But I would love to know what persuaded her to take this part.
So I read on Wikipedia, which is never wrong, that she replaced somebody else last minute. And I wonder who the other person was where Sarah Brightman was her replacement.
Right.
Exactly.
Wow,
like,
yeah.
You never know. I mean, this movie had a really insane production schedule and production history. I want to talk about this with you later once we talk about how the plot kind of falls apart like a really well-made braised short rib at the end of the third act. But it's insane the way that they put this movie together and the stuff that is on the cutting room floor that you read about a scene and you're like, wait, what? That's in there? Okay, great. I'll just roll with it. But no, the fact that Sarah Brightman came in last minute as a part of this insane production blows my mind. And I still don't know. I can't imagine the role being portrayed by anybody else.
Right, because she is so good in it. Yeah, yeah. You said that Lionsgate effectively disowned the movie, and they clearly did after they'd seen the final result. But on the other hand, you have to give them props for actually getting this made, and by the looks of it, giving the filmmakers a pretty free hand. You know, the very nature of this movie and the way it was made and the team that they assembled, I can't imagine they thought that it would ever be anything more than much more than a cult hit. And yet they, you know, they pressed ahead and made it anyway. That's, I think that's quite admirable.
Well, so you're right. The crew that they assembled for this movie is more than a little unorthodox. They got Darren Lynn Bousman to direct, who he is famous for Saws 2, 3, and 4. And then somewhere between 3 and 4, or maybe even after 4, he made Repo. And they, ever since, he's made a few other like small B movies. One of them was a remake of Mother's Day from the 80s, which I thought was more than a little ridiculous. But ever since, he's been pigeonholed into this role of the weird rock musical guy. He has two movies out now in the Devil's Carnival trilogy that isn't complete, but it's more of the same with a lot of the same cast and crew, where he makes these micro budget weird musical movies.
Well, and that's from what I read, that was actually devised by him with one of the principal songwriters from this movie, the guy who plays the grave robber.
Mm-hmm. The guy that plays the grave robber was the original writer and has always played the grave robber in the original Broadway show or off Broadway shows.
There you go. But I must admit, actually, after watching this, I want to see The Devil's Carnival now. I'm actually interested in watching that.
I can't recommend it. I cannot recommend it.
Oh, no,
it. It's
really?
Kind of crap. I mean, and crap in the way that this movie is admittedly crap in some ways, but does not have the charm or fun of this movie. I mean, go see it if you want. It's 45 minutes long.
And yet, it gets way better reviews than this.
Wait, what?
Seriously?
The Devil's Carnival gets better reviews than Repo, the Genetic Opera.
Yeah.
I have not heard anything about this.
That's, yeah, no, I checked it on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah, it got better reviews than... So go figure.
Jesus Christ. I mean, Devil's Carnival is an entirely separate podcast from this. Like I remember, okay, brief tangent. I remember seeing The Devil's Carnival. They released it in the same way they did after Lionsgate disowned Repo, which is they grabbed the movie, booked a bunch of small theaters around the country, and toured with it. So I saw The Devil's Carnival with the hype that they made Repo, one of my favorite movies, and that they would be doing weird slideshow things, and the directors and producers and some of the actors would be there. And that was a ton of fun. After the credits rolled in The Devil's Carnival, I thought, what? That was it? It has next to no plot, whereas this, you could argue, is too much plot. And it's not nearly as fun. Go see it if you want. It's 45 minutes long, and I believe it's on Netflix, maybe even UK Netflix. But
it also only cost $500,000 to make, apparently.
Exactly, yeah.
But yeah, this
compared
gets,
to this $8.5 million
this thing. Gets Devil's Carnival gets 69% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Huh, maybe they're just catering to their audience more, because I can't imagine this has, 69% is still not stellar, but I can imagine
that compared
critics,
to Repo, which gets like, what did you say it was, 32
30
or something?
Yeah.
You know, that's a genuine hit compared to that.
Oh, Jesus. I mean, okay. So the way that Repo came about, I think, is amazing, but as the movie goes on, it kind of falls apart. But it starts off really strong, I think. What did you think of the, I've been led to believe you know something or two about comics, right? What'd you think of the very opening?
I liked it in that it is unusual to actually open a movie with, you know, okay, we're going to show you a comic book now to give you a bit of backstory, and the sort of the comic book fillers in between as well. They felt a little superfluous because they told you things that were then immediately explained in song following. But I liked them in the sense that they were unusual and different, and I found that the same guy, actually, that Darren Zdunik, who, you know, the original writer who played the grave robber, he did those because he is also a trained animator and storyboard artist.
He has a comic out called The Molting, I believe.
Ah, okay. But that also speaks to one of the things that I that frustrates me a little about this sort of thing. They are done very much in a style that is becoming almost de facto for motion comics as part of features and movies and stuff, which is this sort of quasi-photorealistic, trying to make the things look like real people, like real actors style, that I think is just a little stiff, and, you know, I'm not, as a comics guy, I'm not that keen on. But the main thing that frustrates me is, and if anybody out there makes motion comics, for God's sakes, please, will you employ proper letterers? Oh my God, this is a rant I could go on for hours. It does my head in that the lettering on these things is always so bad. And I'm like, guys, there are hundreds of professional letterers who would do this job for you and do it very well for a very reasonable price. You know,
it is god awful.
It is terrible.
Well, I mean, as a very, very light comics reader, I've read The Watchmen, I've read some of 2010's Uncanny X-Force, but the way that they do the lettering in this opening sequence to Repo, it reminds me almost of like the Moby of the comics world, wherein like people are freaking out about the way that the text is presented or the way that something is animated. Because you're right, the way that they do the weird photorealistic cells that are drawn, I guess it has to like break out of some kind of uncanny valley. I watched the Watchmen motion comic after the movie came out because I was so like, ugh, that movie. But I watched the motion comic after the movie came out, and I think that the way they tried to do it there with all of the like slightly animated and all the weird little things, it's some weird uncanny valley of like, this is stills slightly animated. Yeah. It's not animation. It's not a film. It's not filmed, but it's something in the middle that needs to break out of both of those. And I don't think it works very often.
Motion comics is a really strange medium. I have actually written motion comics, and it is a strange medium to work in. It's not, as you say, it's not quite there. It's still sort of trapped in an uncanny valley. But all that aside, and even the bad lettering aside, as I say, I did actually appreciate, okay, you know, some comics, that's good, and that it is, as I say, it's genuinely unusual. You know, it's not something that you see much of in movies at all. But then, of course, as the movie rolled on, and I realized that this is like, there are many movies I've seen and many things in general I've seen that claim to be a bit gothic and you know, sort of appeal to the gothic crowd, and most of them are clearly made by people who have no idea about goth subculture. This movie, oh my goodness. I mean, honestly, if people that I recognized from The Fox on a Saturday night before Slimelight had walked on screen, I would not have been surprised, you know? This was my scene in the 90s, and oh my goodness, they clearly know what they are talking about, because It just looks like a night at a local goth club. It's incredible.
It really does. This is one of those things. Well, for me, it's a horror movie. It's a musical. It's a rock musical at that. And it's got that really great goth sensibility that is very genuine. And
genuine. Yes, that's exactly it.
For any one of those three things, that'll sell me on a movie. Like, I will see almost any horror movie that comes out, any rock musical that comes out, anything that's at least purported to be gothic in a genuine way. And this has all of that. This is one of those movies where, you know, the second I saw the trailer, I knew I was hooked, because it had all of those things, hit all of them. From what I could tell on the very first trailer that came out, it hit them all right on the nose. And what bothered me about the way they marketed it was, like, they had no idea who this movie was for. The directors did. So they brought it out on tour, and it became mildly successful there in a cult way, where it's like, oh my God, were you there at the original screening in Boston for this? No, I haven't. It's one of those cultures. But you're right. Like, this is one of those, like, screenings of this movie do feel like those, you know, 90s punk goth nights.
Right. And again, many of those people are also Rocky Horror fans, and are the sort of people who go to midnight showings of Rocky Horror and shout back at the screen, you know.
I'm raising my hand right now, but you can't see it. There's a place in Boston that does Rocky Horror every single Saturday night, and I've gone
every week. Wow.
Every single week. Some weeks are dead, some weeks are, you know, thriving, ridiculous, like Halloween especially. I've been the past three Halloweens, it's been incredible. But you're right, the same sensibilities are there, where people will yell back at the screens, do shadow casts, act out the movie in front of the screen, and do weird little like performances as the movie's going on. Everyone's singing along. It's amazing. It's those same kind of cultures.
Wow. And one of the other things about this that reminded me of Rocky Horror, not just Rocky Horror, but as I sort of had it in mind anyway, is that most of the people, you can tell, are having a ball actually acting out these parts. I mean, Anthony Head, who's clearly having a great time playing this sort of conflicted semi-villain, but also Bill Moseley and Ogre from Skinny Puppy, and they are clearly enjoying it as well. And even Paul Sorvino, who, I mean, he was well cast, but you do kind of think, what on earth is he doing in this movie? But he seems to be getting into it. You know, everybody seems to be enjoying making this movie.
Mm-hmm. And especially the way these characters are written, that's all part of the Largo family. And they're the main villains of the movie. The way that, you know, you have Paul Sorvino as the patriarch, and then his three kids are Bill Moseley, Paris Hilton, and Ogre. And they're all fighting over his inheritance because he's about to die soon. That's the big, like, spurning event of the movie, is that he announces, or he finds out that he's about to die. And he saved the world. He's like a Nobel Peace Prize winner for making sure that everyone has the organs they need to fight organ failure. Or epidemic or whatever. And they're all written so purely evil. Paul Sorvino, maybe not as much because he has a soft spot we see at the end, but oh my God, Bill Moseley and Ogre are so insanely pure evil and ridiculous. And they have these like one little traits that they really exploit on. Bill Moseley plays Luigi Largo, who's extremely violent, and Ogre plays Pavi Largo, who's extremely sexual. And they just play those things out throughout the movie so much. They have one song called Mark It Up, where it's a duet between them fighting over who gets the inheritance of their father.
One brain, mark it up. Only I got brains enough. That's why Pop will leave Gene Code to me. Me, 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 me.
Ask Jensen who they prefer. 10 out of 9 will say the Pavi. The most dashing, fancy snatching. I will leave your diapers dripping. 2 hearts, mark it up. Pavi steals all of the hearts.
You ain't got the guts, brother.
I'll bark, but no lungs, brother.
That will leave Jinko to me.
And one of them stabs an employee, and the other one is like stealing their underwear as they go. And it's the most ridiculous thing. That's what sold me on the movie first when I first watched it.
Oh, really?
It
was, that scene?
They pulled that off in a way that was funny. Yeah. And that, like, it looked at least, you know, mildly theatrical, the way they were, like, pacing around the set, the way that he, like, scales that one ladder and, like, rips off his shirt. I thought that scene sold me. I don't know. Maybe I'm just weird, but I love that scene to death.
Yeah, no. It's Grand Guignol. It's the theater of the grotesque. and they do it very, very well. You know, blood flying everywhere and the desperate dying employee in this pool of blood trying to sort of get somebody to help her. And the hyper-sexualized assistants and nurses, of course. Well, and we didn't mention Rotty Largo's bodyguards are two seemingly mute women in fishnets, miniskirts, and carrying AK-47s. It's all very, stylized. And kind of like hyper stylized as well. It is really like a very gothic, very over the top. Like I say, it's the Grand Guignol. None of this is meant to be naturalistic. And if you go in expecting that, you know, I mean, it's a musical for heaven's sake. Of course, it's not going to be naturalistic. But yeah, they do hit the notes, if you'll pardon the pun, of the characters extremely well. Every character is very sort of purely drawn. If you like, you know, you don't have any, there's no mistaking the personality and motives in many cases of the characters. There's no confusion there, which unfortunately, you know, is let down a little by the fact that the story itself is so convoluted and isn't as direct as the personalities. Maybe they felt they had to make up for, you know, for the simplicity of the characters with a complicated story. I don't know, but that's the one thing that does let it down. As you mentioned,
I feel like
the story is very convoluted.
It really is. I feel like it's the same problem that True Detective Season 2, plug for that show, has this year, in that there's too many characters and they want to do a plot. So they have to really boil the characters down to their essence in order to make the plot work. There really isn't one overarching plot in the movie. There's more like four or five subplots that all intertwine and weave together. And it works in a way because it gives characters these really great, like, monologue songs. I'm sure there's a better term for it, but they have these songs where they croon about what they're doing and why they're doing it, how they feel. And it works sometimes, but not all the time. I feel like, you know, going back to something you said about the, about Largo's assistants and their, like, cool little, you know, AK-47 miniskirt outfits. I think that they, this movie does such a great job of capturing like that mood, that sensibility. You could tell with the production design and the music that they hit exactly what they were going for, in my eyes, at least.
Exactly, yeah.
But they end up, like none of the characters really are fleshed out until the very end. And even then, most of them are dead.
Right, right. I mean, they do manage to... You're right that there isn't really one overriding story, but they do manage to tie them all together in a way mm-hmm. that at least, I mean, it's not especially novel, but it works by having everything be connected. And they do bring it all together at the end. I actually feel like the last 15 minutes of this movie are some of its best, including some of the songs and the music, actually. If more of the movie had been as good and musically as strong as the last 15 minutes, I think overall it would have been a much better movie.
Ooh, interesting. See, I feel like the last 15 minutes are where at least the plot falls apart. But, or maybe a little bit more than the last 15 minutes. Once Shiloh ends up at the opera and goes into the bowels of the building and try to figure out what's going on, I feel like that's where the movie falls apart. But the music, you're right, is fantastic. Oddly enough, that is the one chunk of the movie that is not on the soundtrack, which I am so infuriated by. The part where Shiloh comes out and everyone has a gun, they're yelling at each other in song, using motifs from older songs.
Yep.
That whole sequence is not on the soundtrack.
How very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundtrack itself, we haven't mentioned this yet, the soundtrack itself was produced by Yoshiki from X-Japan,
mm-hmm.
which blew my mind. When I mean, he didn't write it, but he did produce it. And that's, I mean, what, I don't know how much you know about X-Japan. I know a little because my partner Marcia is, you know, has some of their stuff. Mm-hmm. She loves all the old Visual Kai stuff from Japan. And Yoshiki actually lives in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after, you know, because X-Japan is a fairly old Japanese band, and he now lives in LA, so I'm assuming that's why he's the guy who they got to do the soundtrack. But just the fact that they even knew him and knew who he was to approach him and say, oh, he'd be up for this, it blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. I know very little about him, but I know he was pretty integral to the way that the movie came together and the way that the soundtrack and the movie's music was produced. Because, I mean, it was all very influenced by, you know, 90s grunge and industrial music, like Nine Inch Nails and Tool and all of those bands. And I don't know much about X-Japan, but I guess it makes sense that he was brought in to produce this and make it exactly as weird as they wanted it to be.
Yeah, well, they were a sort of quasi-gothic, not very gothic, but, you know, quasi-gothic heavy rock band who were very, very successful in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also, we should... you know, address the elephant in the room, there is more than a hint of Evanescence in the soundtrack
yes.
here as well, especially because the one character we haven't mentioned yet really is Shiloh, Anthony Head's character's daughter, who even sounds a little bit like Amy Lee when she sings. And I don't think that's a coincidence, you know?
So to me, I grew up in the 90s. So Spy Kids was one of my favorite movies as a kid. And that was Alexa Vega's big break. And when I found out that that chick from Spy Kids was in a horror rock musical, that was another thing that sold me. There was every single bit of this movie sold me on it from the moment I heard about it. But the way that she comes on and sings a bunch of her songs there, I never made the connection to Evanescence. I feel like Amy Lee is way better than Alexa Vega, but she had
she's a better singer, but I think there is a similarity in tone, and especially when you put it on top of the kind of music that is here is very reminiscent of some of Evanescence's lighter fare, I think.
Mm-hmm. She has a song called Infected, where the driving force of the first verse of the song is like a little tinkling piano. And then the second verse is a lot of guitars behind it that sound very grungy and rhythmic and really propel the song forward. So I guess that makes sense. I honestly never listened to much Evanescence.
what is expected when you are infected. That's what is expected when you are infected. How much of it's genetics? How much of it is fate? How much of it depends on the choices that we make? He says I have a rise, do I also inherit his shame? Is heredity the culprit? Can I stop it or am I a slave?
I'm a music junkie and I'm a goth music junkie especially. So, and I'm I'm an unashamed Evanescence lover. I know that it's not trendy or fashionable or whatever, even within goth circles, to like Evanescence because, you know, they're regarded as a pop band. But I think they're a really good band.
I think they're great too. I just haven't listened to much of them.
Right, but I've got all their albums. So, so yeah, when I heard this, I was like, wow, this really reminds me of Evanescence.
Mm-hmm.
But she's, again, she's good. And it's a shame. I gather she got like a golden raspberry or something for this movie.
I talked a lot about a lot of this on True Detective too, but I feel like she is the best actress in the movie that has one of the worst written parts.
Right. Yeah, I could say that.
Yeah. I think her songs are very good, but I think her like naivete doesn't work for Alexa Vega as an actress, if that makes sense.
Mm.
So, her arc in the movie is that, she has a blood disease and can't go outside. And that's all we get for that exposition. We get blood disease, can't go outside. And we learn that in one song. And it's like, it's another one of those like simplification moments that we just need to get off the bat so that we can propel the story forward. But I wish there was a bit more about what blood disease this was. But her arc is that she can't go outside. She learns everything through books and watching things through her window, which she sings about later in the musical, and sneaking outside every so often while still taking her medication, making sure she's back inside within, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes. And the movie ends with her like overcoming everything and overcoming her father, who ends up being a very repressive force in her life. And her songs are all very simple and like teen goth, if that makes sense. So they drew from Evanescence in that way.
Yeah.
As in she's like a 13-year-old girl, and she has one song midway through the movie called 17, which is pretty pure punk.
And I was going to mention that because I think, I mean, you're right that she is a fairly thin character and not well written, but that I think it actually is one of the high points both of the movie and her character.
Oh, definitely.
Partly because it is a really good song that is sort of stands out against the rest of the movie in musical terms, but also because I just think it's really well done, actually, really well handled, and it certainly doesn't hurt that it has Joan Jett actually making an appearance playing guitar. Joan Jett.
yep.
Once again, you're like, oh my goodness, how did they get these people?
Mm-hmm. No, they managed to assemble the weirdest, most amazing group of people to act and produce the movie. And that was one of those moments where, like, by that point, all of the weird characters are basically revealed. So the fact that we get the guy from Buffy, Paris Hilton, and the girl from Spy Kids out of the way, that's cool. And nobody knows who Bill Moseley is when I show it to people. But, you know, if that's people know who Bill Moseley is, yeah, I know. Anyway, brief tangent. I'm trying to get my girlfriend into horror movies, so I've shown her The Exorcist, Evil Dead, and I'm working her up to Texas Chainsaw and Texas Chainsaw 2. So she doesn't know who Bill Moseley is, which makes me sad. But we get another weird little cameo character in Joan Jett. And that's another one of those little fun moments that sells the movie to people where it's like, oh my God, I can't believe that this person's in this movie for, you know, 30 seconds. And you're right. I do think it's one of the high points in the movie in terms of, you know, the fact that it just kind of transitions from a normal scene right into this weird little punk song in her head with Anthony Stewart Head and just kind of there watching, being like, oh God, what is my daughter doing? And I think it works extremely well. You're right. And then Joan Jett shows up, which is fantastic.
Yeah. It's probably worth at this point saying to listeners, if you are the sort of person who would go, like, that's amazing that they got Joan Jett to do a little cameo in this movie, then you will like this movie. It is very much, very targeted in that sense. If, you know, you genuinely like real, as you said, genuine goth culture, not sort of playing at it. And yeah, you're the sort of person who would see Joan Jett in a cameo and go, oh, brilliant, that's Joan Jett. Then this movie is for you.
Yeah, well, Okay, now that you brought that up, who do you think this movie is for? Like, what kind of person would you show this movie to on a night where you got a few beers and you want to watch something silly and fun that you can sing along with if you want?
Honestly, I would show it to my goth friends. I think whether it was deliberate or not, I think this is, they made a movie for drunk goths to sit and have a laugh with, you know? And that's not a bad thing. I don't mean that, as I say, I don't mean that in a disparaging way at all. Mm-hmm. I really think that's, maybe it wasn't deliberate, maybe that's not who they were targeting, but that's what they ended up with, is a movie that I could put on at, you know, a house party with goth friends and just stick it in the corner, and at least half a dozen of them would sit and watch it and be laughing and singing along.
Mm-hmm. No, that's exactly how I feel. And the way that Lionsgate, instead of targeting that demographic, just kind of shoved it under the rug, that is what upsets me the most. I feel like this movie could be way more, at least well-known, in the way that people know Rocky Horror, even though it may not be their favorite movie or a movie they go see once a year on Halloween or something like that. Repo could be one of those movies if there was more actual backing from the studio and not just the guerrilla advertising that the director and producers did. Like you said, this feels like a movie right up your alley and you'd never heard of it until now.
Right, exactly. Well, and there is some solace to be taken, you know, take heart that Rocky Horror itself, the movie version anyway, was not an immediate hit. That took a long time to become a genuine cult hit and to get to the point where movie theaters were showing it every week at midnight on a Saturday, as you said. So maybe there is hope for this movie to become that kind of cult hit yet.
In 30 years.
Well, yeah, it didn't take quite 30 years, but,
yeah,
you know, if word can keep getting out to the right people, to the right kind of crowd. I mean, let's be honest, a lot of Rocky Horror fans are not goth fans. You know, mm-hmm. what they actually love is the sort of the throwback, nostalgic, Gernsbackian craziness of Rocky mm-hmm. Horror, or they like the sexual freedom angle of Rocky Horror. And honestly, I think those people would probably like this movie as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think anybody who likes Rocky Horror should probably watch this movie. But I do think if you are of the gothic persuasion, then you really should watch this movie, if nothing else, just so that you're aware of it. You know, I didn't think it was the greatest movie ever.
It's not.
Right. But I enjoyed it fine, and I really appreciated that somebody had made a movie like this.
No, you're definitely right. I mean, we've talked about all the people that this movie could be for, and it's starting to make me think that this movie should have a wider audience. It really shouldn't. It has a bunch of appeal to a bunch of very specific niches and subcultures, which is what we've been talking about this whole time. And I feel like, you're very right. This is far from the best movie ever. This is one of my favorites simply because it hit me right at the right time in my life.
Sure.
Where I was able to see it many, many times, and I was able to have a group of friends that also loved it as well. And we watched it together all the time and came up with our own weird little Rocky Horror ritual things to do during the movie. It was a fun time in my life, Anthony, believe me. But the way that after I saw this movie, I saw Rocky Horror, and I saw all of the different like ways that they were very similar, and the ways that they took very similar sensibilities from Rocky Horror to make this movie, and it spun it in a very different way, but it ended up creating a different movie in my eyes. So I don't know what to say about the overlap between the Rocky Horror fandom and the Repo fandom, but I know there's a lot of Rocky Horror fans that don't like Repo fundamentally, because this was a big thing that blew up on message boards once the movie came out and hit the right subcultures, was that this movie stole a lot from Rocky Horror, which I thought was complete crap, but you could see the ways that they did in a very loving way, if that makes sense. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. Yeah, I think that's absurd. Rocky Horror is 30 years old, 40 years old, if you're talking about the stage play rather than the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, yeah, no. just no. You can't
you.
Accuse something 30 years later of saying, well, they stole our movie. They are obviously, well, I think it's obvious, paying tribute to mm-hmm. Rocky Horror. Like I say, I know you said you're not sure if that's deliberate, but I think it's quite deliberate that these people are clearly fans of Rocky Horror and want to do something in a similar vein. Not actually, it's not like they're stealing songs or scenes or even characters. I mean, the closest analogy of a character would be the Grave Robber character with Riff Raff.
Mm-hmm.
And even that is actually completely different. They're not at all similar, but that's the closest sort of analogy that you can make. So no, I think those people are mistaken. I understand the desire to defend something you love that is not widely known. Hey, I run a podcast, you know, like this. So I totally understand that desire to sort of say, hang on a minute, we did this already and nobody knows about it. That's not fair. But I don't think that's the case here at all. I think that is a knee-jerk defensive reaction. And that actually, if you compare the two semi-objectively, as objectively as you can, then I think you'd see that this is much more of a loving tribute than some kind of ripoff.
I wholeheartedly agree. First of all, let me clarify. I mean, I do know that these people love Rocky Horror and loved Rocky Horror before they made Repo. So the way that they, I don't think they set out to make a homage to Rocky Horror Picture Show, but it came up in a way that I felt was organic, not like from the word go. It was like, let's make this a homage to Rocky Horror Picture Show and then build a story around that. I feel like they built this story and then they were able to flesh it out and visualize it with Rocky Horror Picture Show sensibilities, not necessarily like paying homage.
Right.
If that makes sense, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll never really know, you know, without directly asking them. But I can see where you're coming from on that, certainly. One thing that amazes me, rewind a second, you said you saw this before Rocky Horror?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
I was more in the horror movie scene before I was in the musical scene. So I got into this movie. Based on the fact that it was made by the guys who made Saw.
Daryl and Basman, his production. That's actually what drew you to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then I got into musicals, and then I discovered Rocky Horror and drew the similarities. I also didn't see it. Oh God, cut this out. But I saw this before I was actually legally able to go to a midnight screening of Rocky Horror in America. So
why do you want me to cut that out?
Because I'm too young. It's embarrassing. I don't know. Anyway, you're right. I was brought to it by Darren Lynn Bousman, who directed Saws 2, 3, and 4. And then I got into Rocky Horror Picture Show after that. But
wow.
It was a weird world to be in because this movie, I feel like a lot of it had to have been lost on me before I'd seen Rocky Horror Picture Show. But it hit me at just the right time where the right kind of humor and the kind of splatter guts humor especially the scene Thankless Job, which I'm still amazed they're able to pull off make funny. But, you know, this hit me at the right time in my life.
Wow. Wow. You really do make me feel very old. As I say, I'm not sure if I'll necessarily watch this again, but it's certainly, but I might, and I certainly might recommend it to friends to see at least once, because, yeah, I think you're right that this has been undeservedly overlooked.
Indeed. I do want to talk to you about the very end. You talked about how the last 15 minutes might have been your favorite and the strongest points in the movie. And I feel like that's when everything falls apart, when all the character motivations kind of come together in this weird opera that we don't entirely understand. It's called Repo! The Genetic Opera, because at the end of the movie is the genetic opera where Sarah Brightman's character Blind Mag does her last performance as a Gene Co. employee or someone who's commissioned by Gene Co. or something along those lines. And every single person ends up being on stage at this opera at the very end to do a weird kind of farewell to Paul Sorvino's character while also revealing to everybody else the big twist to the movie based on all the stuff that happened years and years before. I feel like that is where the movie falls apart, and all of these big convoluted plot lines that we've been able to keep separated throughout the movie come together in a way that doesn't feel very organic, and then we get this blitz of music and blood and ridiculous stuff going on. And I can objectively say that, like, the plotting in this movie is pretty lame towards the end, in my eyes.
It's pretty dicey throughout, let's be honest.
Oh, exactly. But I still feel like I love this movie for everything else that it does.
Oh, sure. But no, I think it comes together in a relatively organic way. I mean, yeah, it's a musical. It's always going to be stylized and some elements will be contrived because it's a musical. You've got people walking around singing at the top of their lungs.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that the way they brought things together was fairly, you know, it made sense within this convoluted plot that everything would come together at the end here. And I don't know, maybe it was just because I thought the songs in the last 10 to 15 minutes were some of the, basically from the moment that Blind Mag takes the stage to sing her final aria, I think from there on, the music is the strongest that it's been throughout the movie, with a couple of exceptions such as 17 earlier, you know, in the film. But for the most part, I think this musically is the strongest part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the songs are strong as well. Not just the music, but the actual, the book and the lyrics and the melodies are very strong, very good. Whereas a lot of the movie, because it is done like an opera, where almost every single line is sung, there is, unfortunately, throughout, there is very little, there are very few moments to hang your hat on, as it were. There are very few moments that are catchy and have you wanting to sing along, which in a regular opera, sure, okay, fine. But this is a rock opera, and it is being sold as a rock opera. And in a rock opera, you expect a time warp or a sweet transvestite. Mm-hmm. Or a touch me. You know, you expect that kind of something that gets you going and that you can maybe sing along to and is quite catchy. And I felt like there really wasn't a lot of that, certainly nowhere near enough of that, until we get to this last part of the movie. And then suddenly we have these songs that actually sound like rock songs and not like noodly instrumental prog rock passages for 30 seconds.
Oh, definitely. I feel like I remember listening to a commentary track on the DVD of Repo, and they talked about the song Zydrate Anatomy as they need that kind of pop rock kind of time warp.
That's
song.
One of the better ones.
Oh,
yes,
definitely.
Yes.
So they threw that in. They threw 17 in there. And you're right. The rest of the movie is much more speak sung, or at least like
Sprechgesang, as they call it. Yes.
So we get like really beautiful, moving moments in lyrics such as industrialization has crippled the globe and nature failed as technology spread, which are like, those are two lyrics from a song called 21st Century Cure. And it's like, come on, you could have done so much better than that.
Right. It's pretty hard to scan that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But no, I feel like the very end has some very great musical moments. And like I said, it's not on the soundtrack. So maybe I don't have as much of an affinity for those moments because the soundtrack was constantly on loop throughout, throughout my high school and college years. But it ended up being something like, I don't know. I feel like the best moment in the very end of the movie is like a single verse that Alexa Vega sings as she's pointing a gun at Paul Sorvino. That was my favorite moment. I don't know if you remember that one.
I do remember, when she turns on.
I feel like that's what you're talking about in terms of like actually finally good rock music in this rock opera.
Yeah. Well, and also, I'm trying to do this without giving too much away. Anthony Stewart's Head's song in that piece towards the end of that scene as well, I thought was, and he does a sort of semi-duet with Shiloh, the daughter character.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was very, you know, that was actually quite sort of gentle. But again, it was good. It felt more like, okay, I'm watching a rock musical now.
Mm-hmm. No, that was one of my favorite songs for a while, too. The song's called I Didn't Know I Loved You So Much, and it's between the two of them. And it's sweet. Like, that was a weird moment for me in terms of, like, the rest of the movie was this very, like gritty, real bloody kind of movie like that. But then this really slow, gentle song between them happens at the end. And it's a good break from all the rest of the stuff that's been happening, but it really doesn't pick up after that.
Right. Well, that's true. But yeah, you do need those sorts of, you know, this is actually, okay, that's crystallized something. What you need in any piece of music, mm-hmm. is highs and lows.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have variety. You've got to go up, you've got to go down, you've got to go up. Because if you're up all the time, then you lose the impact because there's nothing to compare it to. There is no light without darkness and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the movie actually feels kind of flat in that sense, in that it is, a lot of it's a similar sort of tempo. You've got these guitars going constantly underneath. And it's not that it's bad so much as if there was more variety, if there was more up and down, maybe musically the rest of the movie would work better as well. Whereas, again, I feel like the last 10 minutes or so, there is a lot more of that variety. And maybe that's why I prefer it.
That makes sense. I mean, you're right. A lot of the movie is very high in terms of energy and a lot of the other stuff that's happening. And then the last two songs, which are called I Didn't Know I Loved You So Much and Genetic Emancipation, are nowhere near, they don't reach the heights of the other songs. Not in terms of like musicality or skill or anything like that, but they are simply slow songs. So,
yeah.
You're right. It is one of those things where you need much more variety and you need much more going back and forth between like high and low in terms of energy. What would you say is your favorite song, or single favorite song in the movie?
That's a really tough one. Possibly 17, possibly... Sorry, what's Zydrate Anatomy, that's it. Possibly that one, possibly 17. Is it The Man Who Made You Sick, or, you know, that whole sequence there where you get, where they're all on stage at the end and you get the story revelations. Mm-hmm.
No, I definitely.
Because I did really enjoy that.
Yeah. No, that's definitely.
But I thought that I enjoyed Zydrate Anatomy mainly because Terrence Dunick is really good.
Drug market, submarket. Sometimes I wonder why I ever got in. Blood market, love market. Sometimes I wonder why they need me at all.
Zydrate comes in a little glass vial.
A little glass vial?
A little glass vial.
And the little glass vial goes into the gun like a battery. And the Zydrate gun goes somewhere against your anatomy. And when the gun goes off, it sparks and you're ready for surgery. Surgery.
He's got a lovely sort of baritone voice.
Oh, yeah.
He looks good. He's a good, he's clear, you know, he's a good actor. He's got some wonderful facial expressions. And his timing on the music, his musicality as a singer, even though he doesn't, you know, sort of belt things out as much as some of the other singers, his musicality is really, really spot on. You know, he, the combination of movement, acting, singing, timing, that all goes into making a narrative musical performance. I think he pulls off almost better than anybody else in the movie. You know, I mean, maybe that's because he doesn't have an awful lot to pull off in terms of his character. Only appears on screen a few times, doesn't have to do lots of complex stuff. So he has a slightly simpler task in that respect. But nevertheless, what he does, I think he does really, really well.
Oh, certainly. And you're right. He isn't in very many songs. He is probably my favorite performer next to Sarah Brightman in this movie. But the way that he does, especially in Zydrate Anatomy, that low kind of crooning, almost speaking or whatever the term is, he does it very, very well. It's rhythmic. It's creepy. It's you connect with him on a very, very good level that you reach with a lot of really good Broadway performances. I don't know. I think that he does very well. And you're right. He definitely has an easier job than most other people, even though he, you know, wrote the movie.
No, but I mean, in his performances. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. If you like him, maybe you should check out The Devil's Carnival, because he spends the entire movie, he plays Lucifer. So he spends the entire movie devil horn makeup and prosthetics, and it's insane. He has nails that are 6 inches long as he's flipping through books, really, really creepy. Give it a shot if you like his vocal performance.
Yeah, I was okay. That's double sold me. I am definitely going to watch that movie.
Let me know what you think of that, because I'm really curious. I do not like it nearly as much as I like Repo, but to each his own. My favorite song in Repo is one we haven't touched on at all. It's called "Get Your Bleep Thing Ready." It's called "We Started This Opera," and it's
oh, that's when they're all walking into the opera for the final performance, isn't it?
That's when the band starts playing, and they all have these beautiful golden masks, and they're playing. This, it reminds me almost like a Broken era Nine Inch Nails, with like very bump 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 bump, and this really great Pretty Hate Machine era Nine Inch Nails synth track going over the entire thing, and everyone's screaming and shouting, everyone's yelling "Testify!" and
everybody, get down now, stand up, don't be shy, people get up, everybody testify.
Right.
that is my favorite song in the show, by bar none.
I did enjoy that. That was good. Yeah, actually, I'm going to rewind a little of what I said. Yeah, it's probably from that point onwards that I thought the movie really picked up, because Chromagia, which is Blind Mag's last aria, actually comes shortly after that, doesn't it? So,
Certainly. And then, for me, that's where the movie falls apart, when Paul Sorvino tries to sell Shiloh on killing this grave robber, or no, not the grave robber, killing the repo man. And then on the cutting room floor is a scene where Grave Robber shows up in the background of her exploration in the depths of this building while Chromagia is going on or something. I still don't understand it. The song is very good. It's called Needle Through a Bug, but there's a weird scene where Grave Robber shows up for some reason that's never actually explained, and they sing a duet together just before she meets the Repo Man.
Huh.
So I don't know. It's look at the Wikipedia page for the stuff that was cut, and you'll see why they trimmed it down, but it also makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, despite it making no sense, I did enjoy watching it. So thank you for bringing it to my attention, if nothing else.
No, of course. And for anybody who's listening to this, if any of this has sold you, if anything about this show has piqued your interest, or you think that this might be something that's up your alley, if you identify as a musical fan or a horror movie fan or goth or any of those things, at least check it out, because Anthony here has not heard of it, and he at least did not regret it. So there you go. That's your that's how we're gonna sell you on this. It's on
that's a ringing endorsement.
It's on American Netflix, and go right ahead and give it a shot.
All right, let's bring this to a close. Brian, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
If you like what I have to say, God help you. But I'm also on Twitter @_BrianHamilton, spelled with an I. I have my own movie recommendation podcast, completely spoiler free, called the ADR Podcast. And I do a podcast with Kyle Seth Gray called Garrulous, where we talk about whatever the heck we feel like. Usually it's Apple Watch or whatever weird jobs Kyle's doing, which is very fun. I also did Game of Thrones and True Detective this season, if you're still just catching up on those shows and want to hear me and a bunch of other really great Incomparable panelists recap those shows. Go back and listen. They're right here on the Incomparable Network. And yeah, those are the things I'm doing.
I didn't realize that you'd done Game of Thrones. Well, I haven't been listening to that one because I actually stopped watching it about a season and a half, maybe 2.5 seasons ago. So I there's no point in me watching the recap.
No,
listening to the recap. Yeah. Sorry, I should
say. That's where I got my start. What happened was Jason was going on vacation, so they posted on Twitter, "Hey, who wants to come on and do this show?" That was literally
wow.
Yeah. I'd been doing my own podcast for a little bit, but
Valar Podcastis. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please check out my comics, books, and music. I can't offer you a gothic musical, but if horror and the macabre is your thing, you may enjoy some of the many horror books I've written. From contemporary psycho-supernatural, to sci-fi slashers, to creepy Lovecraft mythos tales, and much more. Go to anthonyjohnston.com, where you will find information and links to all of my work. Please also consider rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. It is the best way to spread the word about the show, and is very much appreciated. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable, and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Yeah, again, seriously, thank you for bringing this to my attention, because, as I say, about halfway through, I was like, wow, like, I can't believe, you know, I'm not in the goth subculture as I used to be, but nevertheless, I still have many, many friends, you know, in that subculture, and I still take an interest, and I'm just amazed that I did not even know this movie existed.
Right.
And I bet, it sounds like, I'm going to guess an awful lot of my goth friends haven't either. Crazy, because it is, as I say, you get, especially having lived through the wilderness years of goth in the 90s, as I did, when there were literally just a few thousand people in the UK sort of keeping the flame alive, you know, you'd go to a gig and you would see the same people at every gig, no matter where it was in the country.
Oh my God.
And having lived through that and sort of carried the torch, you become very sensitive to fakery. You know, you can tell when somebody is kind of appropriating the image and the aesthetics without really understanding what they are doing, you know, without understanding the fundamentals of it. And within, yeah, 5-10 minutes of this movie, I was like, okay, these guys are clearly, you know, one or more of them is an actual goth.
Mm-hmm. No, indeed.
there's no question about that, because you don't get the details that they did without actually knowing what you're talking
right,
about.
Right. Well, the thing is, I saw this before I saw Rocky Horror, and I remember when I saw Rocky Horror, which I had been told was the mother of all cults, weird goth movies, and it was relatively light, especially compared to Repo in my eyes, because Jesus Christ, I was, I'm going to show my age again. I was more of the, for a few years at least, before I realized how stupid it was, part of the Hot Topic goth thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, like there's no, because especially in America, you know, which is such a huge country, it's difficult for a movement like goth to really take hold in a country that size in a large, wide way without, frankly, you know, some company pushing it behind. It either takes, you know, a massive musical hit or, yes, some kind of merchandise. I mean, the early 90s industrial rock movement exploded because of some hit records, but they were, most people were exposed to them, to bands like Nine Inch Nails, Ministry and what have you, through MTV, back in the days when MTV used to play music, you know, and show music videos. So, and of course that was gone by the 2000s. MTV no longer showed any music whatsoever, apart from maybe the occasional, and I was going to say behind the music, but that's VH1.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
It? So, yeah, so they showed no music at all. So, so how else are people going to be exposed to this sort of stuff? So I know a lot of people are really down on Hot Topic, but I never had a problem with them, because how else are you going to spread this sort of subculture? Because it is a subculture. I mean, it's much more widespread now than it used to be, but it is nowhere near mainstream.
Oh, definitely.
You know, it is still a subculture. So do not apologize for being a Hot Topic kid.
Well, maybe I feel like, okay, the company has gone really downhill in the past few years, and it's been all, you know, Doctor Who and My Little Pony, and exploiting those fandoms in a way that does not feel genuine, as opposed to the very back of the store where they have racks and racks and racks of metal t-shirts, which feels much more genuine. And you're right. I mean, God, I wish we had talked about Nine Inch Nails more on the show, because that is really what got me started on like industrial subculture kind of things. But hey, at least now, like, even if you don't like identify as 100% goth, at least now you have thrashed it out and all those things to, you know, keep that flame alive in your own life, at least.
Bless you.
Speaking of which, holy shit, I'm in love with Thrash It Out so far. God, you jumped off Game of Thrones at just the right time. I feel like this fifth season, not only was it, in my eyes, the most...
Wait, fifth season? Oh, God. Wait, was it... Wow, I jumped off it. The last episode I saw was the one where Daenerys used her baby dragons to fry the merchant and you know, effectively free the Unsullied and make them her army. That's literally the last episode that I watched.
Are you serious?
So,
oh my God.
Yeah. So that actually, that's maybe that was three seasons ago.
Three seasons
my goodness.
Ago, yes.
Wow.